Survivor's Guide to True Crime includes discussions of sexually based violence and is not intended for children. Information provided should not be used as a substitute for professional medical or legal advice. Please exercise discretion and self-care.
I'm just a control freak who hates being high or drunk, so.
Welcome back to Survivor's Guide to True Crime. I'm Kim.
And I'm Kara. We're so glad you're here this week. We have a great episode for you.
So it's such a conflict in my mind because for as much as I hated being out of control in any capacity, one of my poor coping skills right after I was assaulted in college was binge drinking.
Yeah, well, how?
Which almost doesn't make sense.
How else are you supposed to dissociate? Come on.
Yeah, I couldn't do it because my brain was on, and that may be part of that, Hey, undiagnosed ADHD, but I always thought that it was so interesting because I don't want a loss of control. I can't have any kind of mask over my eyes. Like, people have sleep masks and stuff, and I cannot. Like, that is the one thing, even though I've worked through it, it wouldn't necessarily trigger me, but it is not something I am ever going to be completely comfortable with. It freaks me out, and that's one of those residual impacts.
I mean, I feel the same way about things being over my mouth, like even a blanket, anything being over my mouth. I don't feel triggered. I'm like, I just don't want to do it.
Well, and I mean, you're obviously not going to not associate that with a ball gag in your mouth against your will. Just like I'm not going to be able to associate something covering my eyes as not a black shirt. So, I mean, it sucks. It's not debilitating, but it is something that we avoid, and that's okay. Yeah. But I didn't like losing that control. And yet I would drink in excess and I don't know, just not great.
So like, what's the difference between avoidance of something just because you don't like it versus a trigger?
I guess
it would be, does it put you back in that panic response, right? I guess because we've done EMDR or we've worked through the trauma side of it. I guess a trigger would be something that throws you back into that scenario and that fight or flight response.
Well, and I'd even take it one step further because a trigger would be something that impacts or hinders your ability to function day to day or at the capacity that you need to. A trigger, a true trigger, you can't necessarily get out of immediately. We hear the word triggered all the time, especially like on freaking TikTok or whatever it might be. Oh, I was so triggered. But a true trigger is one that you can't just say, I don't like that, and move along. It's all consuming. It impedes your ability to go on through your day and function at a normal cognitive level. Actually avoiding something because you don't like it, yeah, it can feel icky and you can think about it the rest of the day, but you're also able to function in a way that, all right, I know that I'm avoiding this. You're self-aware enough about it and you're able to move back or avoid that as a conscious decision.
I got it. It's like being allergic to something as opposed to just not liking something. Like, I don't like olives. I don't want to eat olives. They don't appeal to me. I'll eat them if I can't avoid it, but I prefer not to have them. I'm not allergic to them. I don't need an EpiPen, right? Like, I don't need to go to the hospital if I eat an olive. So I think that's a good analogy. I'm good at the analogies. So it's like the difference between being allergic to something versus just not liking it.
So, for instance, we are allergic to rapists. Probably a fair thing to say.
I feel like that's saying, like, I am allergic to arsenic.
I am allergic to persons-based crimes.
I am allergic to belladonna.
Oh my God. All I can think of when you say that is Practical Magic.
Yeah, I know. I've seen them.
Goes right in hand in hand with you watching Mayfair Witches too, which we talk about in this episode.
I take a lot of suggestions on what I should be watching by our guests' suggestions of what they've been, or Kim's suggestions of what they've been binging, you know.
So this week was spring break.
Oh, yeah.
Mike and the boys went down to Arizona. Mike is the Colorado delegate for the National District Attorneys Association, and they have quarterly meetings. Well, this one was just down in Phoenix, and we decided he can take the boys to this one because we're taking the littles with us to Chicago next week.
Yeah.
My whole family is from Illinois. I was born in Illinois, grew up on my grandparents' farm there. Like, we have been in Colorado since I was 2 and a half. But when I thought of home, it was Illinois. So for Mike and I to be able to go to Chicago and give this speech for In Violence Against Women International's annual conference, I am just thrilled, excited, like in a different way. You know how you have some of those engagements or speeches or talks or trainings that are just different? Mm-hmm. This is going to be one because my family's coming up and they get to sit there and see this presentation that they haven't seen before. They've seen me give a solo one in some capacities, but not the one with me and with Mike. And the kids get to come. They're not going to be in there.
Does that feel weird?
Huh?
Is that weird?
No, it's not, because my family is very, very close. Mm-hmm. And when we went through that trauma in 2006, 2007, court, all of that, that was my mom and dad's lifeline, was being able to talk to everyone there. My uncle and my grandma flew out within the week just to be here. My aunts came out. They were there in trial with us the entire time. I went back and we were in Illinois for a few weeks during that summer just as a reset. And like that is my safe space. I'm not worried about what I say or changing the presentation. I'm worried about them having those memories. Mm-hmm. And maybe triggers, but yeah. We all experienced it together in different ways. We talk about vicarious trauma all the time. And that's one of the things that we all went through, was having family that was states away, yet very involved in what we talked about constantly. So I'm looking forward to it. The littles won't be in there for that part of the presentation. We will start off once again with my 911 call. And it really grabs the attention of the audience, which I've said in episode 2, if you listen to that one. It's attention grabbing, but it's because it sets the tone for how different someone who just experienced that level of trauma is from the person that's presenting today. Mm-hmm. So they won't be in there for that part, but like question and answer and the fun.
Oh, because your family will be there.
Yeah. Yeah.
You might give it together. So that's something, when I was traveling, not last week, the week before, I was speaking to someone who travels for work as well. And he was saying, you know, your kids are getting old enough that you can start taking them with you when you go on these business traveling trips. And I was like, yeah, but what do I do with them during my presentation? I don't necessarily, it's not that they don't know, but it's not that I necessarily want them sitting in there. I was like, well, what do I do if it's just, you know, me and one of my kids? And so I'm trying to figure that out, because I feel like it is not necessarily common that you have a job where you can travel. Mm-hmm. And what he said is, he was like, you know, you have to buy them a ticket and you'll have to pay for their food. He's like, but I will tell you that the experience that you get and the connection, everything that you get, it's well worth the like $500, whatever you spend. Totally. Like, and if you're just taking it out of your speaking fee, then at the end of the day, it's not that bad. And I was like, I definitely agree. I'm just trying to work through, what does that look like if I take a 9-year-old with me? You know, where does he go? What do we do with him? So,
well, and that's very different from any other type of speaker. You have a motivational speaker, somebody talking about leadership. They can sit in the back with an iPad and headphones, and you're not going to alter what you're saying at all.
Right.
I don't ever want my kids to be part of that prior to the time that we decide they're ready to hear the full shebang, which probably won't be till near adulthood.
Yeah.
Frankly.
Right.
I don't want to hinder any of my candor or my ability to talk about things or answer questions because my kids are there.
Right.
But yeah, they are at that age now where I can start taking one at a time, and it would be an awesome experience for them.
Yeah.
But yeah, what do you do during, any great tips or suggestions? Because we're not just going to go on care.com and leave them with a stranger. Right. We all know now what happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're not the ones to suggest that to.
No, I was thinking about it this last trip, though. I was like, man, it would be so fun if I had, you know, my older son with me. I was thinking about, you know, being gone for a week and all the things I was doing. And I was like, oh, he's at the age now where, oh, I'm going on a hike. He could have easily gone on those hikes with me. They were difficult, but he's old enough that he definitely could have done it. And I was like, man, that would have been really nice to have had him with me that time. So that was kind of the first time that I was thinking about it. And like, oh, I would like to have, you know, one of my kids here, which is funny when you transition out of that phase where it just feels like survival in parenthood. You're like,
yeah.
Oh, I feel like I'm just, you really rely on me. And I hate to say that your kids are a burden. I don't ever want it to feel like that. But sometimes when you
are. Parenting can be a burden.
Yeah. And when you're healing too, like, so I feel like now my kids are really at the point where I actually enjoy them more.
Yes. That's what I got out of this week too.
Yeah.
I genuinely loved hanging out with them. And we went to this place called Urban Air that's like an indoor park of fun kid things, ball pits, go-kart track, like the sky hanging thing or whatever, like a zip line sort of deal. And we had so much fun. We stayed the entire time that it was open. I had my computer in case I needed to take some breaks and do some work, and I really didn't. I got all of the germs in the ball pit and was full on participating and playing with my kids in a way that is age appropriate. They can run and scream and be as loud as they want to. It was just fun. I want one of those chairs that like you can
do that. I will have one of those in my office when I have a house again, which exciting news. Exciting news, people.
Do I have, to do this.
Yeah, we bought land. I didn't tell you.
No, what? Kara, God. I have been vicariously fretting for you, you. What?
Sorry. Yeah. So it was very spur of the moment. I know. Sorry. So for those of you who are like, what is the big deal?
Me.
Kara and her family have been living in a camper on borrowed land for close to a year. And the plan was we would travel. That did not pan out because my husband has severe back problems that we were trying to get figured out through insurance and all the things. And so for that reason, we are more stationary for the past year in the RV. We sold our house at the top of the market, blah, blah, blah. The plan was to find land and to build on it. We had two separate opportunities where we had land that was like right in front of us. Here it is. It's in this community that you love. And then at the last minute, not going to happen. So it was kind of heartbreaking to experience, to be quite honest, but it was a definite growth opportunity for me because I could feel myself withdrawing, which is my runaway tendencies when I'm under stress. And so it was just kind of like, you know what? Let's just see what else is out there. And lo and behold, we find this piece of land that's been on the market for 200 something days we'd never seen before. And I showed it to Joe and I was like, this looks pretty great, right? And he said, yeah, let's go ride and look at it. So we rode over there with our friends and neighbors. They rode with us to go look at it. And we go out there. It's in like, it's still as close to everything as we are now. So still relatively close to things, but feels like you're in the middle of the woods. And we go out there, we drive down into like the little clearing and we get out and you just hear like nature and the wind blowing through the trees. And it's like two hills on both sides of the property, 6 acres. And it goes down to like a little valley in the middle. And so it feels like you're in the mountains. And we just got out and we were like, yep, this is it. And so we made an offer on it. And that was, so we went and looked at it Saturday. We made an offer on Monday. It was accepted. And we closed on it at the end of the month. Mm-hmm. So it's great. It feels nice, too, to know that it's not a lot of back and forth. We're like, oh, we have land.
When you know, you know.
Yeah.
And so I'm so happy for you. And 6 acres.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the plan, it's surrounded by nothing. It's just more land around it. So the plan is we will probably build like a shop with like an apartment above it. And honestly, probably live in the apartment above the shop while we build. So that's kind of the plan. And we'll stay on the lake through the summer and then probably start working on all of that soon. Yeah. It feels good. It feels good.
Oh, that's, I mean, F you for forgetting to tell me, but also like, what a huge deep breath. And it's a perfect, hey, this door is closing and you couldn't understand it at the time and it hurt and it was awful, but it was closing so that you would look and find this piece that's been sitting there waiting for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I feel like a marker of growth and healing and help is when the shit hits the fan and you look at it and you're like, well, this sucks, but it means that there's something else on the other side. It means there's something better. Mm-hmm. I don't want people to mistake me when I say that bad things can happen for a reason, because I don't believe that things happen for a reason. But I think that very, very, very often when we are in a place that is healthy and whole and mostly healed, we can look at things that happen and we can find reason in the bad things that happen. So you know, as all of that was happening with the other opportunities, I honestly, we had so many things that were just, it felt like a hailstorm. We just had so many things that were coming in all at once. And I just found myself laughing. Like when so many things hit the fan, I literally am like, oh my God, how is this all happening? I'm just crying, laughing. And I was like, this is ridiculous. And like, I know there's something better, but it sucks right now. But I found myself recognizing it and being like, okay, well, there's a reason why that didn't work out. And so it was really cool to watch it all kind of come to fruition. It all happened when I was traveling. Joe like made the offer and everything. That's why I didn't tell you probably.
Oh.
Because I was traveling and then I was sick and then I was forgot that I did. I don't think I told anybody.
And you got to celebrate your anniversary knowing that next year will be a very different environment.
Yeah, my anniversary just passed 12 years and there's a video on TikTok and Instagram if you want to watch it.
It's so disgustingly cute. My mom's like, wait, where did Kara get married?
Freaking paradise.
I love it. My mom fans for you like you're a second daughter.
She sent me a photo or she sent me a message. She has my phone number. She sent me a text message a couple weeks ago. She was like, I just saw you on, I think it's like Daily Blast or something. Who knows.
I know. She told me she texted you. I was like, okay.
I know. Cool. I get messages from people and I'm like, I don't even remember doing that. Like someone sent me a message recently and they're like, I just saw you on this show. And I was like, I did not do that show. They repurposed that from something else. And they're like, but I'm watching you on it right now. And I was like, yeah, I'm telling you, I did not do that show. They repurposed it from something else that is owned by their network. She's like, well, it's this episode. And I'm like, I didn't do that. Like, I think I've sent you screenshots of it before. It's like this interview where I'm wearing like a blue shirt and I look so young and I look so weird. Like, it looks like I changed my appearance or something. I look.
Is that the originally like Investigation Discovery or something?
Yeah, I think it might be from Investigation Discovery or the I Survived or something. I don't know. There's a lot that I did during that time frame that I don't really remember and I'm not super invested in because I wasn't involved in it and I didn't really have the best experiences with all of those. So
yeah,
they exist. They're out there. So if that's how you find me and that's why you're here, then that's great. But just know that there are better things out there that I actually played an active part in. Look for those instead.
So I was saying that we're taking the Littles to Chicago next week with us. I am a consultant for In Violence Against Women International, and I will be actually working the conference. Mike will be with me because he is a presenter and also my man candy, tall drink of water, what have you. So we went out to visit my family and did like a road trip out there, which I love. I remember being young and going across I-80 at least 4 times a year. So for road tripping wise, it was great. And then we got to go back and stay on the farm with my aunt and uncle, and they got to play with cousins, and it was lovely. When we went up to Chicago to leave, we stayed up there for 2 nights. Mike is scared of heights and did not go to the Sears Tower. I don't care what the name of it is now, it's the Sears Tower. So I took all 3 boys. It was so much fun. We loved it. But the one thing that our daughter wanted to do while she was there was get her ears pierced. And not just get her ears pierced. She wanted to get them pierced at the American Girl doll store. So she would have been 6 years old at the time. To me, ear piercing has always been a touchy subject. And without getting into the circumcision debate here, I want to talk about consent. You're going to hear in our episode today with Allison from EVA a little bit about when to start teaching kids about consent. It's the time that they're verbal. I got to wait until I was probably in 3rd grade or so until I got my ears pierced. One of my cousins waited until she was in high school, but when I see babies with ears pierced, all I can think of is A, sometimes it's a cultural thing, and B, that baby didn't get to choose that. And it rubs me the wrong way, but I also understand like it's a practice, it's a family thing, whatever. There's a million different roads we could go down to discuss this. So for me, I always wanted to make sure that any kind of ear piercing was always her choice at that moment, and nobody is going to make her do that or not let her when she is ready. We get to the American Girl doll store, middle of summer. She woke up early that morning, took her shower, did her hair. Like, this is all she could talk about for months leading up to it. She is skipping down Michigan Avenue into the store. It's the cutest little video. She's so excited. We had an appointment. We go upstairs. It's like the 3rd floor to the American Girl salon. So you can get your doll's ears pierced or your actual ears pierced there. It's all 6 of us. And we are at the little counter. You know how they have it's like a plastic thing with all the different earrings that you can pick out for studs to put in. She's looking through there and she picks out Pink Ice. She's so, so happy. Well, we're waiting for the gal to come in and do the ear piercing. And I'm filling out the paperwork. And she's sitting in Mike's lap in the chair. And you just kind of see her start to stare off and sort of check out. And she's usually really talking a lot and bubbly and excited. And she wasn't. And we look over at her and we're like, honey, are you okay? You still want to do this? And she's like, I'm just really nervous. I'm like, that's okay. You know, I think we said, well, what questions do you have? What do you need? I don't know. I don't know if I want to do it now. Mind you, she's been talking about this and is so thrilled, even just a few minutes ago. And we're like, honey, you can say no at any time. She's like, but you already paid. Doesn't matter. I will crumple this paper up right now and get rid of it. And Mike said one of the best things I think I've ever heard. He goes, you know what? It's really brave to get your ears pierced, but it's also really brave to say that you don't want to get your ears pierced. And like, she wells up tearing. And so we walk out. She's like, I don't think I want to. I'm like, okay, that's great. Let's go look at American Girl doll stuff. And then the whole time she's like, oh, it's like that adrenaline letdown. Oh my gosh. She needed somebody to give her permission to have her voice, and it's over her own body. And like, it was one of those parenting moments where I'm like, we've been doing something right.
Yeah.
She felt okay saying this, knowing that the whole family made sure to come to Chicago so that we could go to the American Girl doll store to get her ears pierced. And for her to choose not to was such a win in my book. And I have just been so, so proud of her speaking up for herself in that way ever since. Now, this was 2.5 years ago now. For the last year or so, she's been, okay, now I think I'm really ready, because some of her friends are starting to get their ears pierced now. And okay, I'm ready. All right. Can we go back to the American Girl doll store? I'm like, oh yeah, we'll just hop on a little 2-hour flight on over. Well, then Mike and I get selected for the closing plenary session at the conference. I'm like, this is perfect. Let's have them come out with us. And so we have another appointment made for the American Girl doll store for her to go in and get her pink ice earrings. And it's going to be the same thing again. If we get in there and we've already paid and done all of it, if she even gets one done and then doesn't want the other one, mm-hmm. she gets to say no at any time. And I cannot think of a better way to reinforce what consent is than that sort of story. But it's not just ear piercing. It can be anything. Anything at all. If you put that power of making that choice in their hands, it's going to matter a whole hell of a lot more when they're older and when it's potentially dangerous to their bodies. Mm-hmm. So I'm thrilled.
We have these conversations. I will say it's not unique to just little girls and ear piercings and mm-hmm. things like that. We have this conversation with my older son all the time because he hates getting his hair cut. Mm-hmm. He has a big floofy head of hair. And we're like, hey, man, it's kind of looking a little crazy. You want to cut it? And he's like, no, I like it. And we're like, okay, well, if that's the case, that's fine. Here are the rules. If you want long hair, you have to brush it and you have to wash it. If at any yep. point you stop doing those two things, we will make the decision for you. You know, and that's kind of like that line in parenting where it's like, sometimes you have to do things for their own
hygiene wise. Yes.
Yeah. And for us, that's kind of how we practice that. Or like, if they only want to wear the same 3 shirts, or they want to wear shorts outside during the winter or whatever. Okay, man. But if you're cold, you know, like
natural consequences.
Yeah. But we try to allow them like that autonomy within reason. So it's like, if you see my kids out, like if you see me out with my kids and, you know, it's the dead of winter and they're wearing shorts and t-shirts, listen, it was not my decision. They feel okay. What am I to say? Yeah. Or their hair is looking a crazy mess. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, they don't want to get it cut. And so I just think that there are so many real tangible ways that we can reinforce consent and body autonomy through all ages. And it's just so important. I love your illustration, though.
I know. It makes me so happy. So after our conversation with Barrett, I have gone through and I have stopped putting up pictures yeah. of the kids. And part of me is really sad about it because they are such a huge part of my life and I'm proud of them and like excited and they love sharing things. But at the same time, I'm like, the internet is a scary place. Mm-hmm. So I'll share where I can, but mostly it's just for friends and family now, at least for the kids and yeah. then when they can grow up and own their own digital footprint and yep. have full responsibility over that, by all means. But until that point, this is where we're at in society, which kind of sucks.
Yeah, my kids both gotten to the point where neither one of them want me to share photos or videos of them. They're like, no, don't do that. And I'm like, okay. So, I mean, I Yeah, it's again, it's like body autonomy and digital footprint and all of that. And when you're dealing with gigantic platforms, it's a decision that is not to be taken lightly. I know when I initially was starting my public social media, I debated, should I do a whole new platform that is just for my public persona and keep a separate one? I ultimately decided that was not sustainable for me to have two different Instagram accounts, or this was before TikTok. So it was not sustainable for me to do that. And so I just kind of transitioned the way I was posting and what I was posting and kind of keep friends and family on private Facebook. Basically, that's about the only place that I regularly post those things. And because once it's out there, you can't take it back. And it's not my face that I'm sharing. So.
Right, right. Like we've talked about before, I didn't necessarily have that choice. It was 2016 and it blew up immediately. And I didn't think to have all of my stuff on private at that point because I never needed to.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I did. And so I've always been very careful with what I am posting.
Yeah, which is definitely something that you and I have talked about a few times. When I travel at some point, I would like to be like, hey, I'm in Washington State. Like, let's do a meetup. But it's so tricky because it's like, I don't necessarily want to say exactly where I am, especially when I'm traveling by myself.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't feel comfortable with that. So I hope that you guys will respect that decision and know that when the time is right and when I'm mentally able to do meetups and when I am, from a safety perspective, able to do that kind of thing, I will absolutely share. But I'm just not at the point where that is something that I'm comfortable with yet.
No, I don't know that I'll get there. The ideal world would be someday we get to do a live show. And then you really can come and see exactly where we're going to be for a short limited engagement. But
that would be fun.
That might be a little further off. Yeah. With that in mind, please rate, subscribe. We have our first press release too. We released our first press release to send out. So if you or someone you know has an outlet or the ability to pass this along, it's on our website now. You can just go to survivorsguidetotruecrime.com/press. And get all of that information there. I am really looking forward to today's episode because it's different than what we've been doing. This is not going to be a first-person survivor story, but instead an expert in the field and someone who has worked with survivors for her entire career. So my dear friend and colleague, Allison Jones Lockwood, is joining the podcast today to talk about Start by Believing Day, which is today, by the way. And she is nationally recognized for her expertise managing and assisting victim advocacy programs. So she is with In Violence Against Women International that you hear us talk about here all the time.
Allison is trained extensively on the criminal justice response to sexual assault, including the impact of sexual assault in the aftermath. She's trained countless advocates, law enforcement personnel, and healthcare professionals in local, regional, statewide, and national trainings. Allison began her career working with survivors and advocates within the U.S. Navy and has worked for rape crisis centers in California, Kansas, and Missouri.
Okay, here's our conversation with Allison. Allison, thank you so much for joining us today. We are happy to have you here on Survivor's Guide to True Crime.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We start every interview with an icebreaker. What is your current binge? What are you watching, reading, listening to that you just can't get enough of?
And I'll tell you mine after you say it. It'll make you feel great. Don't worry.
So mine is watching Outer Banks on Netflix with my daughters.
Oh.
With your daughters, that makes a lot more sense. I was like, oh. Okay. Wow. I've heard great things about it.
It's
I have
not great, but it's something you just kind of have to see play out.
I have cousins that are teenagers, and the boy is the one that's obsessed with it. He's like, I just can't stop watching it.
Really?
Mine is Love is Blind.
God, still.
It's a new season. I binged it while I was gone. I'm like, I literally just got on Netflix this morning. I was like, when did the new episodes come out? Because I need to know, because I need to watch them all. It's like Jersey Shore. It's like a train wreck and you just can't look away. And I love it so much.
Well, my answer would have been Ted Lasso, but they only release one episode a week. So I cannot say that I'm binging it. I am patiently waiting every week to watch it.
I love Ted Lasso so much. We held out too. We didn't start watching it until I think the second season was halfway over. And how did I hold off so long? I don't have
it. Yeah. We started it with the second season. We went back, watched the first, watched the second, and then we went back and watched all of them with our kids.
Yep.
Which maybe they're not supposed to be watching that, but
whatever. Not that bad. Kim let her children watch Step Brothers, so it's fine.
Okay, Captain Call Out. That was one time.
It was already on the podcast, so it's already out there. So it just, you know, if it makes you feel any better.
Can I tell you a funny story?
Yes, please.
So Samantha is, she's 11. She'll be 12 next month. She's desperate to cuss. Like, she just cannot wait till she's allowed to say these bad words. And I keep thinking in the back of my mind, like, who needs permission? But so she's taken, when she learned that another word for a donkey is ass, now she just goes around calling everybody a donkey. We are having so much fun with this. Like, she'll be like, you're just a dumb donkey. It's amazing.
That is so fun.
Oh, I can see my kids doing that.
I started watching today, Kim. I started watching Mayfair while I was getting ready.
Is it good?
I really like it.
Yeah, I'm like 30 minutes into the first episode.
So. I really like Anne Rice, not just because vampires, but I like her style of writing about them. And Mayfair Witches is one of those where I'm watching it and I'm like, I bet the books are way better and they're probably leaving a ton of stuff out, because if it's anything like some of her others, they're probably really thick books. And I feel like there's been a few parts that are skipped, but overall, I like the general story. The one that I cannot get enough of, and I'm telling literally everyone who will listen, on Apple TV, it's called Shrinking.
Oh, I want to watch that. It's on my list.
Oh my God. Drop what you're doing right now. It's so great. My comfort show, which we've kind of talked about before, but my comfort show through like basically the worst year ever and trial and everything in 2006 and 2007 was Scrubs. I watched Scrubs DVDs in the victim witness room while I was waiting to testify. Like, that is my tune out. It's funny to me, whatever. It's the same creator, producer of Scrubs does Shrinking. And it has Harrison Ford and Jason Segel in it. And it is hilarious. And it's that dark humor kind. So it deals with mental health and dark humor. It's so up at literally all over the alley.
Okay, you sold it. I'll watch it. I can't watch the amount of TV you tell me to watch.
You travel. It's fine.
I know. I would really rather just hang Hogwarts Legacy.
I was going to say, Kara's going to tune out and play Hogwarts instead. Are you and your kids into Harry Potter?
Yes.
Okay, what? Let's play a game.
I mean, into Harry Potter. Like, I've read the books and watched all the movies and been to Harry Potter World.
Okay, so yes, you're into it.
Yeah.
Let's play a game called Let's Sort Each Other Into Houses. Like,
guess Kim's house. Let's everyone guess Kim's house. It's not hard. It's what you think it is.
The first thing that came to mind is Slytherin.
No, but I've decided that I am, like, internally a little bit of a Slytherin.
I'm an Enneagram 7, if that helps at all.
Helps, yeah. She's a Hufflepuff.
Ah.
Yes. Yeah, I'm definitely a Ravenclaw, but as I'm like playing the game, my husband's like, are you sure you're not a Slytherin? Because it'll be like, go to the common room. And I'm like, bitch, I ain't doing that. I'm going over here. Like, whatever you're supposed to do. I'm like, I don't want to do that. Don't tell me what to do. I'm going to go over here.
So are you a Gryffindor, Allison?
Probably. I mean, is it surprising?
It aligns completely. So get this. I was telling my daughter, because she's just now, she can't quite read the books, but they have really thick hardback graphic novels.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've seen those.
Oh, my gosh. And so they're checking them out from the library and she's really into it. And I was telling her what house I am. She's like, I just want to be in the house with Edward. Because they also watch Twilight. And I'm like,
I would expect nothing from your child.
Anyway, let's go ahead and get into the serious stuff. Tell everyone that's listening a little bit about you, how we got to know each other, and what you do for work.
My name is Allison. I am a sexual assault advocate. I currently work with an organization called End Violence Against Women International. I have been working with EVA International for 12 years. but my background really is in sexual assault advocacy. I've worked at rape crisis centers in Kansas City, Missouri, and San Diego. I actually started out my career working for the United States Navy, running their sexual assault victim intervention program. And over the last 21 years, I've had the privilege of meeting hundreds of survivors that I've worked with, connected with, and really just strive to make the systems that respond better for them.
So we got to know each other, is that 2020 or so? Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, it's been a little while now. Allison had reached out on my website and contacted me because I had worked with Eva for a while before, but never directly, even though I was linking all kinds of stuff. And I loved being able to talk with you directly because it's something obviously near and dear to my heart. But the big thing that you were working on was getting ready for Start By Believing. And listeners are no strangers to us talking about Start By Believing, about In Violence Against Women International, and some of the things that you all do. But specifically, tell us about the Start By Believing program, given that today, the day that this episode comes out, is Start By Believing Day.
Yeah, so Start By Believing, it's a public action and awareness campaign. It was launched officially in 2011, but the idea for it came from our CEO, Joanne Archambault. She, at the time, was a detective in the child abuse unit at San Diego Police Department. And she was realizing as she was investigating these cases that these kids were coming forward, they were disclosing child abuse, child sexual abuse, and the very people that were supposed to protect them were not believing them. And with that, that includes their parents, their caregivers, but also the detectives that were assigned to their cases were not believing these kids. She then went to the sex crimes unit at San Diego Police Department, and the problem became even more prevalent where survivors were coming forward. The detectives were not taking their cases seriously. The survivors were not believed. And she actually left the San Diego Police Department in the early 2000s because there was a lack of training for law enforcement to investigate sexual assault cases. So she formed EVA International 20 years ago. This year is our 20th anniversary, really trying to bridge that gap in training with the goal along the way that eventually, when the time was right, she would launch Start By Believing. And the time was right in April of 2011. We launched the campaign at our international conference in Chicago. Actually, this year we'll be back in Chicago for our annual conference. But 12 years ago, when the campaign was launched, we didn't really have any idea of what the impact of the campaign would be. And I don't really think in anybody's eyes would it become what it is today. Today, Start By Believing is not just a campaign. It's a philosophy really seeking to change the way we respond to disclosures of sexual assault, domestic violence, stalking, human trafficking, child sexual abuse, all forms of gender-based violence. Rather than responding with doubt or blame or shame, Start By Believing seeks to tell all of us to respond with support and empathy, which is really in direct conflict with what many survivors receive when they tell a friend, a family member, a loved one, or law enforcement. Right now, Start By Believing has been launched in 700 communities across the United States. There are 25 different international campaigns for Start By Believing. And Kim, as you mentioned, today is Start By Believing Day. It's the one designated day that we set aside. Of course, Start By Believing is a year-round thing, but it's the one day that we proclaim to survivors, we hear you, we see you, and we believe you. And it's a really wonderful national day of action that communities all over the world participate in.
So if you are listening to this on Start By Believing Day, which is always the first Wednesday in April, Allison and I will be down in Denver and working with the Denver Police Department to talk about when the campaign came to Denver originally. So I was looking back on this, and in 2014, they had asked me if I would be willing to participate and talk about what being believed meant to me as a survivor. I didn't have the knowledge as much about what the campaign was, but I was working in the criminal justice field. I had done victim advocacy, and being able to talk from the side of, yes, being a victim, but also working on criminal justice and being the one that believes others really gave me a perspective that everyone needs to be doing this, whether you are in victim services or law enforcement or prosecution or nursing, or you're just a person who is supporting someone else who has gone through this. Being believed is the most important thing to survivors on their path to healing. And, you know, we've talked about this before, but it always bears repeating. It dictates on that first outcry or two whether or not that victim will go forward and seek crisis services, or if they will report. If you want to hold offenders accountable, this is the way to do it. So I got to participate in that back in 2014. Allison and I are going to be down there again today. And the Start By Believing campaign was not funded for how many years? Yeah. So talk about the funding and what goes into this campaign. What does it mean? Because a lot of people hear Start By Believing, but don't think that they can actually do something about it.
So one of the things that I love about the Start By Believing campaign is it's really accessible to anyone and everyone. We have a number of different resources that are available to communities free of charge. So everything from social media graphics, a social media toolkit, posters, brochures, you name it. We know that some communities have robust marketing budgets that they can use to put towards Start By Believing. Some communities have written and received grants for their Start By Believing campaign, but there's many communities that have no financial resources, but that does not matter because we provide all of the resources that they need to be able to make this effective. And that's one of the great things about Start By Believing. It truly is a priority for Evon International to keep this momentum going. When we launched the campaign in 2011, there was no direct funding for Start By Believing. And to be honest, for the first 9 years of Start By Believing, we just supported it out of our direct funds. We knew that it was a priority to get this message out around the world, across the country. And so we did that with our own funding. Then 3 years ago, we were fortunate enough to get our very first private grant for Start By Believing from the Sorensen Legacy Foundation. And then last year, we were able to add on the Mr. Ballin Foundation as another supporter of Start By Believing. And these two foundations are so important to our work because it's allowed us to expand our reach, expand our message, create new tools, have more support for communities that are considering launching campaigns. And that honestly is how I spend a large part of my time, is supporting communities that want to launch a campaign. They're not sure where to start. They're not sure how to get going. They're not sure how to bring team members on board, or if they have team members that maybe are concerned or not quite as supportive, I can help kind of lead them along the way to get those other professionals involved and engaged.
Hey, Kara, did you know that April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month? Yes, of course you did.
Obviously, I knew that. But did you know that it's also Adaptogen April?
Say what?
Do you know what an adaptogen is, Kim?
I understand all of those words separately.
So adaptogens are essentially some type of compound botanical that goes into your body and helps your body deal with stress. It's non-toxic, non-specific, and normalizing. So what it does is it helps regulate your stress hormones and helps you adapt to stress.
I have some of that, the stress.
Yeah. The good news is that Cured, almost all of their products have adaptogens. So it's Adaptogen April, and they are really doing a push on education around adaptogens. And it is genuinely something that makes them extra amazing. My favorite products with adaptogens are the Rise, the Zen, and the Aura, but they are also in the Serenity Gummies. That's the ashwagandha that you see there. So if that sounds like something you would like to try, head on over to curednutrition.com. Use code KERATIN at checkout to get an extra discount and to support us, and let us know what you think.
My favorite platform to be on right now is Patreon, because I freaking love our captive audience.
Oh my gosh, me too. I think that the conversations over there are so authentic, so genuine. And honestly, because you're choosing to be there, hopefully you really, really like us and you're not going to think that we need to be committed when we are completely unhinged.
I love those conversations. I also love that we've got merch that's available over there and a bunch of extra video episodes. To be able to watch it and have that feedback from the folks who are there that make up our little Patreon community is just so much fun.
Like the real unhinged pterodactyl laughing and me just saying all kinds of weird things that Kim sometimes cuts into episodes. If you like those little kind of things, then you're going to like our Patreon.
But you also get bonus content, early access and news, and the input that we get from our Patreons really shapes what we are doing with this show. So if you're interested, please join us over on Patreon.
You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/SGTC for Survivor's Guide to True Crime.
And you can find that on our website or in the show notes.
So I know the importance of Start By Believing, and I know it in two different perspectives, I guess. So whenever I escaped and I had my first interactions with law enforcement, I felt like I wasn't believed. Now, I went on to work in law enforcement. I had more perspective where I realized it was more of a sense of disbelief, but it did impact me at that point, even though I knew I was believed. It just feels like seriously? Now I have to prove this to someone. And it kind of takes the wind out of your sails whenever you're not believed for anyone who needs to know kind of the impact. I think that's the least of the issues. And so when I went on to working in law enforcement, I took those feelings and I took them to heart, because the hardest conversations I had to have were when I got a sexual assault case that I could not prosecute, there wasn't enough evidence, and how do I make a call to a victim and tell them I have to close this case, because it can feel like they're not believed. And the last thing in the world I wanted to do was make someone feel like I didn't believe them. So I was very lucky that I had someone who was working with me in investigations and more or less training me in investigations that I feel like his knowledge was beyond his time and not something that I had heard before. And I said, how do I make these phone calls? And he said, well, this is what I say. I don't know if it's right, but this is what I do. And he said, I call people and I say, it's not that I don't believe you. I believe what you said happened, but I don't have enough evidence to put before a judge and jury and make them believe that what you said happened. And then I kind of went on to further expand that into, and I don't want you to have to go through that prosecution process, but I just find it so interesting that he was so wise. And now, having learned about the impact of Start By Believing campaign, I realize how wise he was in telling me that.
He was definitely way ahead of his time. I mean, you know, in the last, let's say 10 years, we've really seen more language around victim-centered responses, trauma-informed responses. And I think the three of us, we have a pretty good grip on what that actually means. But for the layperson who isn't engaged in this work, they don't really know what that looks like. And one of the things about Start By Believing is it's such an easy concept to understand. It's just, if somebody tells me they've been sexually assaulted or abused, I'm going to go with the premise that they're telling me the truth, that this is valid, this is real, this is what happened to them. And from there, I'm going to be supportive. And, you know, with friends and family members, they don't really know what supportive looks like. So that's one of the questions I get. What do I say? What do I say? What do I say? How can I be supportive? And it's really simple. It's, thank you for sharing this with me. How can I help you? I believe you. That's it. Friends and family members don't need to know why. They don't need to ask for details. They don't need to understand it. They just need to ask what that person needs from them in that moment.
I think it's so helpful to give people that script too, because that's one thing that I definitely experienced over the years is people don't know how to respond whenever you share this big thing, and they can say a lot of things that can be hurtful, and it's just because they don't know what is the better thing to say. So I love that you just gave people a script. And I think this helps to drive it home for why I share this. I also want to remind people that when you start by believing, you are actually erring on the side of statistics. So would you like to share about the statistics of false reporting?
Yeah, so we know from research that about 2-8% of reports of sexual assault are false. And what false means is it never happened ever. What gets confusing for a lot of folks is law enforcement will report numbers on unfounded cases. And so there's this mindset with some departments that those numbers get kind of shoved into the false report number. And that's really not accurate. It's not an accurate representation of what those truly look like. We have a whole training module on clearance methods and proper ways to clear cases. And if a victim declines to participate after the initial interview, that does not mean it was false. If a victim is unreachable after the initial interview, that does not mean it was false. And so these are just a couple of examples of cases that are sometimes shuffled into this false report umbrella when it's absolutely not true. Are there false reports? Yes, but they're very few and far in between. And unfortunately, survivors for decades have been met with the suspicion that they're not telling the truth. And when survivors are met with that suspicion from a law enforcement perspective, anything that survivor says can potentially further fuel that suspicion. So we have these red flags, right? We know that when somebody's been sexually assaulted, the ability to recall memory is often not linear, or there's large gaps in their memory. And for some law enforcement, both of those are seen as red flags that this person is not telling the truth, when in fact, we know that that's trauma. That's the trauma presenting in the way that their memory was created in the moment. And so the more we can educate on the realities of the way survivors respond immediately and in the days, weeks, and months afterward, the more informed everyone is with what those responses look like, why they're actually common and absolutely normal, then I think we'll start to see that impression of false reports going down.
Today, I was at a high school and I was talking to a friend of mine that I used to work with in law enforcement about the culture that is high school currently. And one of the things we were talking about is how open these girls specifically, but girls are about sharing their trauma and how it's almost like a badge of honor. And then that conversation. And for me, I see that mostly as a positive thing. So I'm like, well, they're not going to feel alone because this is the nature of these conversations being had more often. But then our conversation morphs into how girls in high school will say things. And it's like the things that they have to say to get attention or to shock and awe now are very, very above and beyond. It's, oh, I've been raped like 7 times this year. And it's like, what? So it is the culture for a teenager who someone touches her butt in the hallway. She's like, oh my God, I was basically just raped. And it's like, what? How do we don't have a ton of younger listeners, but I can imagine we have moms of teenagers and people who are dealing with this. How do these kind of mentalities fit into this conversation of start by believing and victim centric? Because I was knowing that we were going to have this conversation and having that conversation right before this, I was like, well, this is a juxtaposition because I know you start by believing, but when you have someone who is saying something like that, is it a red flag because something actually happened or is it a red flag because it's a call for attention? How do we navigate these kinds of scenarios?
I don't know that I have a direct answer, but I have some thoughts. And I think, first of all, when we look at the way some people use the word rape, let's say, for example, somebody was charged a ridiculous amount of money for a product and they say, I was raped. That's happening all Yes. around us. And so when we minimize that word, it becomes less powerful to some people. And I think that's issue number one, is we're minimizing the seriousness and severity of that one word. So one, we need to stop that. But two, in the school district that my kids go to, they have comprehensive sex education. And that starts really formally in middle school. So all seventh graders in our district have a semester-long health class. And they learn the whole gamut of having a healthy body and what that looks like. But they have an entire unit on consent, on sexual harassment, and sexual assault. And they actually, at the middle school level, they have high school peer educators come into the classroom and they do a 90-minute lesson that is mostly on sexual harassment and covers a little bit of sexual assault. When they get to high school, it's the flip. So they still have peer educators in high school, but they go into the classroom and they talk largely about sexual assault and a little bit about sexual harassment. So these seventh graders have the foundation for what those terms mean, why it's important to use them correctly, why it's not okay to throw them around flippantly. And they have a really good understanding of consent. And it builds upon that in high school so that by the time, ideally, in a perfect world, these kids graduate from high school, they go to college, they have this foundational knowledge of what sexual assault actually looks like and why we should take it seriously and what are things that they can all be aware of. So one, we stop throwing around that word in a flippant way, but two, we give kids the education and the foundation for what it truly means when we say that word. I'm going to share a little personal story, but when I was very, very young, I was probably in first or second grade. I was outside playing and we had a lot of boys in our neighborhoods and, you know, we were all just kind of wrestling and I yelled, "Stop raping me." I had no idea at 6 or 7 what that word meant. But my dad called me out and yelled at me and told me that I was never allowed to say that word in that way. I was not allowed to make light of that word. He didn't really tell me why. I just knew from then on that that was not a word that I should ever use lightly. And the more we talk to our kids one about sex, but two about sexual assault, the more they're going to understand the importance of it.
I think one of the most shocking things that I have learned in the last couple of years is that these conversations about not just consent, but consensual sex should start as early as 8 years old. Because if they aren't getting that information from you, they are going to have those conversations and they are going to find out what it means if they have those questions. And being able to start them off on those conversations in this way with consent education, I think sets them up for, gosh, a much deeper understanding of what that means and the gravity that it holds. I had a supervisor at a former job, knowing my background, say, yeah, we just got raped over that. And it was about a business deal. And I'm like, me as a grown woman in my early 30s, advocate, and I still didn't feel like I could speak up in that moment and say, hey, that's really inappropriate. But that is the kind of thing that we need to be doing. We don't have to just sit and laugh it off. And I think about that all the time. I wish I would have called it out in that moment, because you know that's not the first time that he said it, and you know it's not going to be the last.
But it's so hard in the moment, especially when you have that personal tie into it. You have to decide, is it worth my time? Do I have the energy for it? And then you go from there. And to go back to the consent piece, we should be laying the foundation for consent when they can talk. Mm-hmm. And we do that by saying, oh, you don't want to give Uncle Matt a hug? That's fine. Mm-hmm. How about you wave or give a high five? We teach them at that age that they get to choose what they want to do with other people. That lays the whole groundwork. And even like, you know, I have two daughters and they'll fight with each other. And one of them will be, I don't know, flicking the other one's ear. And the other one's saying, stop. I said, stop, stop. I said, stop. And I will swoop in and say, she said, stop. That means you stop right away. You don't wait for the next stop. You stop right then and there. And all of these little things lay the groundwork.
Yep. Yeah, I even find myself, you know, my husband will be like wrestling the kids and they're like, stop. And he's like, oh, he's fine. I'm like, no, you stop. I'm like, that means stop. So yeah, you have to start it so early, and it is continuous. You have to do it. But I just found myself stumped in that conversation with my friend, and she was, you know, she was like, I obviously believed this girl who said this. And she was like, but it's thrown away. So I love that you gave actual tips and ways that we can combat that, because I feel like sometimes it can be so difficult because it feels like we are faced with more sexual assaults than ever. But in reality, it's because more people are talking about it. And so I think anything that we can do that feels like we are moving that needle in some way is helpful.
Absolutely. And in that exact scenario you gave, if I was the friend who heard that comment, I would have said, can you tell me a little bit more about what you mean by that? Mm-hmm. It's a fairly neutral question that provides an outlet for that person to tell you it's not judgmental. It's not doubtful or blaming or shaming. It just opens a window for conversation.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for those tips, because I explained to the students and the few students who stayed afterwards, once we know better, we do better. And whenever we are able to be given the language that is supportive and helpful, then hopefully we can use that language. So I'm just so glad that there are people who are doing this work and giving people the language to be supportive and victim-centric and help create survivors. And I love it.
I don't want to put you on the spot, Allison, but I want to point out something that you specifically do that we have tried to carry over in creating this podcast and just how we interface with our guests. So when Allison reached out to me the first time via email, it was, you know, thanking me for tagging Ivar, for doing things that were online, which was just aligned with the work that I was doing anyway. But she asked if I would be willing to share my story or do any kind of work with In Violence Against Women International. Of course, I'm like, heck yes, I love it. And from the moment that Allison made that first touch point, it was always victim-centered. There's not a brochure or a pamphlet or an email or a pass along of my email address or information that doesn't go through me first. You always make sure at every step of the way that there is consent. And it's not just for me, it's for every single survivor that you work with, because we're not all in the same place. I am very forthcoming and heck yeah, use it however you need to, because it's an organization that I fully and completely trust. But for a lot of people that are learning the ropes, being able to show them and guide them through that advocacy and that victim-centered process is really also a component of their healing. And I have seen you do that over and over again. So anytime that we have people on, for example, some of the guests that we've already have on, I pass them right along to you because I know that that work is so important and those voices and those stories are going to be taken care of with Eva and with you specifically. And so I can't thank you enough for the work that you do because it's not always something that can be taught, but it absolutely is something that we're seeing replicated more and more. And I think that you guys are a huge driving force behind that.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that. It truly does mean the world to me to hear that. You know, when I was a baby advocate, I can remember and point out mistakes that I made along the way. And I can truly say that every single survivor I've connected with, I've learned something from. Whether it was, you know, as simple as learning a piece of their story and how it impacted them, or it was a survivor who taught me how to listen better, or somebody who taught me what sharing stories should look like. You know, these are all things that I have learned from survivors. And, you know, one of the things I like to say is survivors' voices are so powerful because we have so many opportunities to learn. I mean, from every aspect of it, from that initial disclosure to 10 years after the sexual assault, there's so many things along the way that we have the potential to learn if we're listening and if we want to hear it. And I think I've just always kept that same hat on of I'm just going to keep learning along the way. And it's so important to me when survivors share their story with me or they share it on behalf of my organization. I want to make sure that they have full control over sharing their story, that, you know, sometimes we'll draft something. Maybe it's a donation appeal. We're going to send it back to the survivor to make sure that everything that we took from their story is something they're comfortable with sharing, the way that it's shared, who it's going to be shared with, because it's a sign of respect. I mean, it truly, deeply is just a sign of respect.
Yes.
That is what we owe to this person that we're working with, number one, and whose story we're holding for them. I mean, it's just respect.
We come across that obviously a lot on the interwebs and doing what we do here, kind of talking about the true crime genre and the way that these stories are being shared. I mean, think about all of the work that you put into that and the impact that you have on those survivor voices. When on the flip side, you have random content creators or Monday morning quarterbacks that are going to come in and comment, that same care and respect is not showed. Frankly, it's exhausting on this end, but we're gonna keep trying to drive that point home.
Absolutely. And when we first started our Survivor Voices project, it was really important to me that we did it right. And doing it right involves a lot more time than just doing it. And so from the very beginning, let's see, what, 3 years later, I've met with close to 60 survivors, and I've held one-on-one meetings with every single one of them. For them to get to know me, to be comfortable with me, for me to get to know them, for me to also get a sense of whether or not they are at a place where they can share their story in a public platform. There's many survivors who want to, but just are not at the place where they're ready to do that. And that can be very challenging to navigate. So I met with every single survivor individually. And then along the way, I just keep in touch and say, here's something we're looking for. Is anybody interested? And really trying to provide opportunities and platforms for survivors to share their stories that don't otherwise have platforms. So one of the things we've started doing, I guess it's not started, but it's been almost 2 years now, but we do monthly Instagram live interviews with survivors. It was still in the deep of COVID. We wanted to give options for survivors to share their story who were used to going to community awareness events and no longer had that outlet. And so we kicked it off in October of 2021 for Domestic Violence Awareness Month. I think I did 3 interviews that month. And then we've just kept going ever since. And it really has been a great opportunity to give survivors that space. And really for me as the person who's doing the interview, I just sit back and listen.
I am in the same way as you, learning something every single time we listen to those. And it's just done in such a nice format where people don't feel like they're totally on the spot. It's comfortable, it's safe. And I really think that when you create that environment, you get better conversations.
Absolutely.
So we've hit on several things that make what you do victim-led. So for those who are listening, who are saying, how do I, aside from the start by believing, which is very, very important, what does survivor-led conversation, what does survivor-led work? If there were a pamphlet that you were handing someone, since there's not one, what would be the primary points that you would recommend for survivor-led and empowering content and conversations?
That's an excellent question. So I think it starts with what I said is that respect piece. It's respecting that the survivor is a whole person, right? There's a whole life behind that survivor, and their story is one piece of what makes them a whole person. And I think, you know, those of us that are actively doing the work, advocates, law enforcement, medical professionals, prosecutors, you know, we get so laser focused on the survivor piece, it's hard to see the whole person behind. And I actually said this in a presentation that I'm doing for our conference of like, that's one of the core principles of advocates. And that's the one thing that advocates really specialize in, is seeing the whole person and being able to understand how this victimization impacts their whole person and vice versa, right? So their lived experience impacts how they respond to a sexual assault, but their sexual assault impacts their further lived experience, right? And so we can't really provide this full wraparound support if we don't take the time to understand who they are outside of this one thing that brought us together in the moment. And, you know, advocates have the luxury of time to spend with survivors to get to know them and really understand them. And a lot of other people that interact with a survivor, they don't. For the medical professional, it's time limited, right? They're together, hopefully 2 hours, sometimes as much as 8 hours, however long it takes, but that's a tiny window in the time of this person's life. So other professionals, they can do some connection work with the survivor in however limited their role is, to just try to get to know them beyond the victimization. So survivor walks into the hospital and the nurse says, can I get you a blanket? Can I get you anything to drink? Asking questions to really start to build that rapport with the survivor. And then it's simple things like, what do you do? Where do you go to school? What's your favorite sports team? Little ways to just kind of set the survivor at ease. Again, get to know them. And this is also something law enforcement can do. That rapport building stage is so important in the beginning because, you know, the three of us are women. We've all had babies. We've all been in a doctor's office where we're sitting in a gown and we're waiting for the doctor to come into room and do a pelvic exam, right? Now, there are doctors that walk in, throw you in stirrups and go about the exam, and they don't talk to you. They don't let you know what's coming. They don't build rapport with you. And that experience is completely different to the doctor who walks into the room, asks you how you're doing, asks you how your day is going, asks you what you've been up to, asks you what activities you like to do, and just talks with you and looks you in the eye throughout this maybe 3-minute conversation before they start doing the exam. Those 3 minutes set us at ease and make us feel comfortable. And when we replicate that with survivors, whether it's in the immediate aftermath or years later, it sets the stage for the survivor that it is a safe place to tell their story. And that is where law enforcement in particular can get more information. When they create this safe environment, the survivor is going to be more forthcoming with details that they are hesitant or uncomfortable in sharing. The nurses are going to collect better evidence when they know where to collect it from, because the survivor feels comfortable telling them all of the places that they should collect it from. The advocates are going to get better continuation of care with the survivor. You know, sometimes it's just in the hospital that the advocate is there, but where we truly see the impact is vertical advocacy. So that an advocate stays with the survivor throughout the criminal justice process. And the rapport piece of that is the very first step.
Yes. One of the questions I keep seeing pop up either in our DMs or in our personal ones too is folks who want to get involved and they want to either go into victim advocacy, or we have people that are wanting to practice law that want to know better ways to support survivors. Do you have any advice or just ways to start that you would pass along to them?
So one of the first things that I always recommend to somebody who wants to get engaged in this work, wants to help other survivors, reach out to your local rape crisis center, your local domestic violence program, see what they want for volunteers, what kind of volunteer roles and opportunities are there. I can tell you that every single rape crisis center and domestic violence program needs and wants more volunteers, whether it's answering the crisis line, it's going to the hospital in the middle of the night, or it's coming and helping clothing at a domestic violence shelter. If you're not at a place where you can work one-on-one, there are so many ways that you can get involved on a local level and really support a survivor. A lot of these programs also are looking for survivors to share their story. So whether it's in a high school presentation, a community awareness event, or a professional presentation, these programs are constantly looking for survivors to share their stories. And then outside of that, if you've already kind of done that level of getting involved and you are looking for something more, I mentioned our Survivor Voices Project. So we are always interested in speaking with other survivors. If you go to our Instagram, it's EVA International, on our link tree, it has a form for Every Response Matters. This is an outlet for you. You can share your story. It has your contact information. I read every single one of those that's submitted. And then I reach out to the survivor and kind of start that process of getting involved in the Survivor Voices Project.
Yes. It's so helpful. And it's a great way to experience a lot of different scenarios. It's not just the cookie cutter. I was sexually assaulted. I reported. They caught him. They prosecuted him. Now he's in jail. Like, it's not always that way. I think the really important thing that you also bring to light is when people weren't believed and what that can look like. And showing all of these different responses and the ways that people have chosen to heal afterwards has been, gosh, just so impactful. I hope more people go towards that information and consume that kind of stuff because it can make a big impact when somebody does disclose to you. If you follow along with my personal social media or anything Start By Believing on Instagram or TikTok, you're going to see a lot of the things that Allison and I create together, be it reels or just content that we put out. But that's a way to get involved as well, is using that hashtag of Start By Believing. It's especially important today. If you have a story about Start By Believing, use that today. Put it on any of those. We're going to repost as many as we can and see those and get that word out. Another way that you can get involved today is by going and taking the pledge. And I love this pledge page because it's a great landing place to get more information, but to also say that when someone reaches out or discloses sexual abuse or violence which has been committed against them, you pledge to Start By Believing. That's where I send everybody during my keynotes and my presentations. Check that out. It's free. It can be confidential, but it can sign you up for more information if you so choose. But it really puts people in the driver's seat for when they have those responses, because at some point you very well may be someone's outcry and there is no way that you don't already know a survivor, and being as informed and receptive to whatever they need as possible sets us up to move from victims to survivors.
I'm going to take your pledge one step further. So you can go to the website, startbybelieving.org. You can go to the pledge page. You can take the pledge. And then afterwards, you can go to the resources page and you can print off the handheld pledge placard, sign your name, print it off, and then you can take a picture, put it on your social media with hashtag Start By Believing.
Please print those off, tag us, tag EVA. It would be awesome to see as many of those as possible today. Do you want to talk about conference?
So next week, we will be in Chicago for our annual conference. This is a gathering of about 2,000 professionals engaged in the response to gender-based violence. There are topics on sexual assault, domestic violence, stalking, human trafficking. We actually have a few sessions this year on child sexual abuse. It's a great opportunity to network, connect with other professionals. I realize it is short notice to fly to Chicago in 4 days. But we do have a virtual option for the conference that you can register for today. It will give you access to every single session, which is one of the nice benefits of attending virtually, because if you're in person, you are one person, you can go to one session. But if you attend virtually, you can go to as many sessions as you would like.
Oh, and by the way, one of the closing plenary sessions will be yours truly. Michael and I are going to be presenting at the close of conference, and it will be on Start By Believing. So I am very honored and humbled that we've been asked to do that. it's a message that I hope everyone in attendance and online virtually will be able to take with them throughout the year as not just a tale of why you should start by believing, but inspiration to continuously do your job to the best of your ability, because it's overwhelming numbers and ways that you are going to impact lives in the work that you are doing that you may never know about, but I promise you those survivors do.
They sure do.
So Allison, besides what we've already talked about, are there other ways that people can help support what In Violence Against Women International and the Start By Believing campaigns are doing?
Yes. One of the best ways that you can support our work is by making a donation to End Violence Against Women International. Our donations go directly to support our programs, whether that's our online training institute, which is a training program specific to sexual assault investigations. We offer training bulletins, webinars, a very, very, very extensive resource library and resources to continue to be the driving voice in what investigations and prosecutions of sexual assault should look like. So donating to EVA International supports all of our training programs, but it also supports Start By Believing. Your donation to Start By Believing allows us to continue to provide services to communities who want to launch Start By Believing campaigns. It allows us to provide that direct one-on-one support with people or organizations who want to get involved, aren't sure how to get started. It also helps support the efforts to provide resources for free. We have over 30 different graphics for social media that are available for free, 30 different posters. So again, all of these resources, we want to be able to keep them free. And your donation helps support that. But most importantly, your donation helps ensure that every survivor hears the words, I hear you, I see you, and I believe you.
So we've got the resources for Start By Believing and In Violence Against Women International on our pages, on our social media. But Allison, tell us again where we can find that information as well.
So you can go to startbybelieving.org, and there you will find anything and everything about Start By Believing. We have frequently asked questions. We have an about page where you can learn about how the campaign got started, how Start By Believing Day got started. We have resources. We have training resources. So if you are wanting to approach some criminal justice professionals, we've got a training bulletin designated to help you do that. And then, of course, EVA International, we have our own webpage, and it has everything that we offer there.
Thank you so much for your time. And I can't tell you how excited I am to be participating in this campaign and join everybody for conference. It is hands down my favorite conference every single year. And I really hope all our listeners here all get involved and start by believing.
I just want to say I'm so grateful to both of you for the work that you're doing, for allowing me to share space with you. It is a privilege.
Survivor's Guide to True Crime is hosted and executive produced by Kimberly Corbin Rourke and Kara Robinson Chamberlain. If you love what we do here, please don't forget to follow, rate, and review the show in your podcast player. It's an easy and free way to help us and help more people find the show. To learn more about the guests featured or to find resources and information discussed on the show, visit survivorsguidetotruecrime.com. Thanks for listening. Well, see you later.